From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, antidepressants and the medicalization of personality. We talked to psychiatrist Peter Kramer about Prozac and other new antidepressants and their ability to transform personality. Dr. Kramer says these new drugs are raising fascinating but complicated questions about the human condition, such as how much is personality based on biology, and how willing should we be to chemically alter someone's personality. Dr. Kramer is the author of the new book Listening to Prozac, an exploration of antidepressant drugs and the remaking of the self. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album by the rap group PM Dawn. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton issued a lukewarm statement of support today for his embattled nominee for the post of chief civil rights lawyer. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
President Clinton said today he plans to consult with the Senate before deciding what to do about the nomination of Lanny Guinier. Clinton nominated Guinier to head the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division. Guinier's writings about the enforcement of the Voting Rights Act have drawn fire from conservatives. They say she favors quotas and is out of the mainstream of the civil rights movement. Today, the president suggested that some of those attacks distorted Guinier's writings, but he added that he did not agree with everything that she had written. And he said he would be taking into account what her prospects are in the Senate before he makes a decision. There's a debate within the White House about whether or not to withdraw Guinier's name. Civil rights groups have been urging the president to back her vigorously. Some Democratic lawmakers have been urging the president to withdraw her nomination. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
The tiny Central African nation of Burundi will have a new president elected today in the former Belgian colony's first democratic election. President Pierre Buyoya, who seized power in a military coup in 1987, was defeated today by challenger Melchior Ndadaye. Ndadaye will be the first national leader chosen from the country's majority Hutu tribe. He promised a new era of human rights in Burundi. Diplomats in the country said the next test for Burundi's democracy will come when voters choose a national assembly. Foreign monitors said the presidential election was among the most free and fair of any in Africa. The UN's chief electoral official in Cambodia has responded to complaints by the ruling Cambodian People's Party of voting irregularities in last week's elections. NPR's Mary Kay Magstead reports from Phnom Penh.
The UN's reply to the government party's complaints was swift and comprehensive, almost 60 pages of detailed explanations. Zimbabwean Professor Reg Austin is head of the UN's electoral operation in Cambodia.
There is no evidence of fraud, nor is there evidence to suggest that the scope of the problems which have been in existence is sufficient to have a real impact upon the electoral results, such as to justify the rejection of the results.
Government party officials have not yet publicly responded to Austin's explanations. Now trailing 7 percentage points behind the leading opposition party, Funcinpec, they have threatened to reject the election results entirely if new elections are not held in at least 4 provinces. I'm Mary Kay Magstead in Phnom Penh.
Stock prices came to a mixed close today on Wall Street despite reports of a sharp increase in new home sales in April. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was up about a point to close at 3,553.45. Advances edged declines in heavy trading of 287 million shares. This is NPR. Italian Prime Minister Carlo Ciampi said today that the country won't be intimidated by a campaign of terrorist bombings. Police defused a powerful car bomb about a block away from Ciampi's office today. A civil defense official said the bomb wasn't as powerful as the one that killed 5 people in Florence last week, or another that injured 23 in Rome in mid-May. Italy's interior minister said the latest bomb was planted by the mafia in revenge for the arrests of alleged mafia bosses. Earlier today, police said they arrested a top mafia leader in Sicily. The United Mine Workers of America is entering the second month of a selective strike and is expanding that strike to include mines in Ohio. The expansion is expected to begin at midnight tonight. NPR's Cheryl Duvall reports.
3,000 union miners will be called out in this latest expansion of the strike, bringing the total to more than 9,000 in Ohio, West Virginia, Illinois, Indiana, and Pennsylvania. The latest target is Peabody Holding, the same company the union charged with unfair labor practices in a month-long strike earlier this year. Peabody and seven other companies being struck are all members of the Bituminous Coal Operators Association, whose contract with the Mine Workers Union expired in February. The main issue impeding new negotiations has to do with job security, namely who will decide how many active and laid-off union miners will work in new coal mines as they open up. So far, the coal operators and the union have scheduled no new contract talks, and until they do, the union threatens to keep expanding the strike. In Chicago, I'm Cheryl Duvall reporting.
The Pentagon said today that nearly 2,500 civilian workers will be laid off at four Navy shipyards over the next 4 months. Almost 3,200 more will accept early retirement or will be offered bonuses if they leave. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you think your nose is too long, you can fix it. If you don't like your wrinkles, you can get a facelift. Will we soon be able to change our personalities with similar ease by taking a pill to get rid of depression, insecurity, or fear of rejection? My guest, Dr. Peter Kramer, thinks we're entering an era of what he calls cosmetic psychopharmacology. In his new book, he analyzes how Prozac and other new antidepressants are altering the personalities of patients and changing our notions of what makes people the way they are. Kramer is an associate clinical professor of psychiatry at Brown University and has a private practice in Providence. He also writes a monthly column for Psychiatric Times. His new book is called Listening to Prozac. Prozac went on the market in late 1987. Since that time, it has been portrayed as a breakthrough drug, but it has also been accused of causing suicidal feelings and violent behavior in some users. I asked Dr. Kramer what Prozac is typically prescribed for.
Prozac's usually prescribed for major depression, serious episodes of depression that don't seem to be ending spontaneously. It also can be prescribed for a number of other conditions, including obsessive compulsive disorder. But in recent months, I think psychiatrists have more and more been prescribing Prozac for more minor forms of depression.
Now, I want you to give us an example of how you've seen a patient's personality change after taking Prozac. Maybe you can give us the story of the woman who you call Tess.
Yeah. Tess is a patient who was very important to me, I think, in part just because I admired her. This is someone, and do admire her. This is someone who came from a very rough background, a family of 10 raised by an alcoholic father and a mother who had great difficulty and ended up chronically depressed herself at a young age. And Tess took over, raised the family, made sure that all her siblings went through school, ended up herself with an excellent business career, but had very serious trouble in her private life, allowed herself to get into relationships with men where she was taken advantage of, strung along, and had privately markedly low self-esteem, although she did very well in public. And she came to me when she was becoming seriously depressed, and I and her psychologist slash psychotherapist were concerned that she might be entering the kind of chronic depression that her mother suffered at a similar age. And so I started her on a conventional antidepressant and happened to be imipramine, which is called a tricyclic antidepressant, the kind of treatment that was the mainstay of psychopharmacologic treatment for depression since the late 1950s until the late 80s. And she did well. She recovered from depression. She said she was all better. But I thought she was not perfectly well, and my marker for her not doing well was that when she mentioned her boyfriend, she was having an affair with a married man. When she mentioned this married man in the brief sessions we had to review medication, she would burst into tears. And I thought that that kind of vulnerability was not right for a woman of this extraordinary achievement. And when Prozac came on the market, for various reasons, in fact, in part because I thought this relationship to men had a compulsive quality, and because it, for various reasons, it seemed that Prozac might be good for compulsions, I asked her if she'd be willing to try a different medicine, and she was. She came in after a few weeks and said she was better than well, that she'd never been as well as she was then, and she showed what really for a psychiatrist is a remarkable change, for a psychiatrist to see is a remarkable change.
Tell us about some of the changes she went through.
Well, I think the most marked thing was that she was able to leave this boyfriend very easily, without falling apart, without any sense of regret. She had increased energy. She was more assertive at work. But she also seemed to have new social skills. She could spark in court. She could tease and flirt with men. She had confidence in her sexuality. She was able to judge what the right level of involvement with different men was. And I think as someone who's worked with people who get stuck in relationships, I find that those skills seem to take a long time to develop ordinarily, almost to need to be taught. And she just had those skills latently, and they emerged when the Prozac kicked in.
So she went through a very dramatic personality change. But didn't she at some point decide, or maybe you decided, to stop the Prozac?
Yes. You know, ordinarily, the rule used to be, at least, that if a person does very well, perfectly well on an antidepressant for 5 or 6 months, you can stop without great fear of relapse. And we stopped the medicine, and in fact, she didn't relapse in the sense that she didn't have a depression recur. But she came in again after a few months and said that she was not quite herself. I found that statement quite really remarkable. She was more the way she'd been for her whole life, and that now felt to her like not herself. The way she'd been on Prozac for 5 or 6 months now was what she felt was her true self, and the way she'd been for 35 years was not herself. And in particular, she was entering into new negotiations at work and felt that she'd been more confident on medication and asked me to restart the medication in order to increase her level of confidence.
And what was the dilemma for you about whether to start that or not?
Well, that really is not an indication for a psychotherapeutic medication, is it? I mean, that's not an illness. And I think I was able to kid myself and say, well, here's someone with chronic minor depression. Here's someone whose mother did very poorly once she started slipping. Maybe we ought to restart the medication. But I think if I'd been more honest with myself, I think I was really responding to her request, which was she wanted to be more confident, and that more ebullient, buoyant, flexible personality. And she wasn't manic at all. She had no overshot, but that she just had a different kind of normal personality than the kind of normal personality she'd had before her depression. In any case, I think that I was really responding for her request to have a brighter personality. And I gave her the medication, and she had just the response she wanted.
Do you think you did the right thing, looking back?
I think I did the right thing. I think there's an interesting social question, which is, why is it that doctors have the right to prescribe or withhold medication? It's really on the basis of our expertise regarding health and illness. It's not because we have some proprietary hold over these drugs or that we have some moral reason to withhold them from people who wish them. But that is a very difficult question. I mean, really, I think it stresses the doctor's role to have the doctor in charge of a medication that perhaps can do more than alleviate illness.
Well, you've coined a new expression, cosmetic psychopharmacology. And in other words, prescribing pills to change somebody's personality as opposed to get them out of a life-threatening depression.
Well, I think Tess's case made me worry about this. You know, if you only go through life once, why not as a blonde? Well, why not as a peppy, energetic, socially proficient blonde? And I don't think that everybody would respond to this medication the way Tess did. In fact, some people don't respond to these medicines at all. But even if a substantial number of people with normal levels of mood respond to medication with this kind of socially desired change in personality, we have an interesting set of dilemmas on our hand.
Spell it out for us. What are the dilemmas?
Well, I think the dilemma is exactly the one you ask about, which is who has the right to decide whether a person ought to be on these medications? And in addition, I think there's another issue, which is are these medicines somehow analogous to steroids in sports? If some people go on these medications that are more confident, assertive, perhaps even quick-thinking at business than they were off them, does that put implicit coercive pressure on other people equally to take medication or some other way to achieve that level of assertiveness? In fact, the medication made me think about our society. I ask in the book why it is that medicines like Valium and Librium were so popular in the 60s and wonder whether they were related to our wish to have women stay in situations which perhaps should have made them anxious, but instead persevere. I think now we demand that women, and women are the people most often prescribed psychotherapeutic medication, that now we demand that women go out into the workplace and succeed, and by luck, we have a medicine that may help them do that. So I think the medicine may be a boon, but it also implicitly may be socially coercive or induce a kind of conformity of temperament. I talk in the book about, as an example of this, about mourning, and I'm not the first person to write about this, but in rural Greece, there's a wonderful book that describes mourning rituals in rural Greece. And in rural Greece, women are expected and even required to mourn for predeceasing children or spouses for 5 years. And this is wonderful in terms of the amount of time it allows people for healing and growth, although it is stressful for some women who are so flexible that those 5 years are really burdensome. Well, our society doesn't allow people to mourn for 5 years. In fact, psychiatrists and internists will think about giving antidepressants after 6 months or a year if someone is really handicapped by grief. And by the way, most people are. Mourning, I think, naturally goes on for more than 6 months or a year. So we're a very different society, and I think the availability of this medication will highlight the extent to which we demand flexibility and resilience in people.
So you're cautioning us that there's a question now of whether we'll be altering personality to conform to the cultural norms of the day.
Yeah, I think there's a cultural norm for temperament. If we think about women again, the woman who is loyal, willing to stay at home, I'm not sure I'm going to get the list of characteristics I want, but who is sensitive, shy. You can look back to the Victorian literature and find these women as heroines of literature in the 19th century, although there's a tradition of the kind of spunky heroine as well that goes back to the 18th century, going right up to the present. We may not reward that temperament or personality today. I think today we may say to that woman, you're not going to do as well if you don't go out into the world and respond to changes in cognitive set very quickly, respond to changes and demands on you. In fact, there's an interesting study by a person who primarily studies monkeys. And he studied, instead of a colony of monkeys, a colony of mildly depressed women in California, had them come in for hundreds of hours of testing. And he came to believe in these women that their primary problem was not depression. Their primary problem was temperament. That is, that these women were not very outgoing. In fact, there was an interesting little sidelight to the study, which was that when the women went out for lunch, they wouldn't come back on time. So he sent his researchers out to follow the women and see what they did at lunch. What they would do if they came, let's say they had to go to the bank and the greengrocer and the butcher and the laundry. They'd come to the bank, there'd be a long line, and they would just stand on line instead of having the flexibility to move on to the next task and come back to the bank later. As a result, they wouldn't get their tasks done at lunch. And he hypothesized jokingly that the last two or three people on a long line will always be people with minor depression. Now, what he found was that these women had, if you look at this sort of an anthropologist, had less living space, fewer friends, less money. In fact, in general, fewer of the goods of life that lead us to be resilient and less depressed than women who weren't dysthymic. And his conclusion, which may or may not be right, but is very interesting, was that the primary problem in a number of mildly depressed women is that they have this more reserved, inhibited temperament, and that depression is secondary, that the depression is really on the basis of deprivation.
That's really interesting. Would this make the argument that it would be doing them a favor to treat them, that they'd get more of what they deserve in the world?
It certainly does them a favor in this society, I suppose, to treat them if you can make them less inhibited and more outgoing. On the other hand, I suppose we could say it enforces a level of social conformity. I think the doctor faced with the individual patient almost always has to give the drug because that patient needs to do better in the world here and now. But I think we could say as a society, are we doing the right thing if we don't create a place where people with that temperament, which is a normal temperament, which has persisted for generations and centuries, is able to succeed?
If you're just joining us, my guest is Peter Kramer. He's a psychiatrist who teaches at Brown University and is the author of the new book, Listening to Prozac. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Dr. Peter Kramer is my guest, psychiatrist and author of the new book, Listening to Prozac. Has Prozac changed your sense of your job and your power? I mean, as you write in your book, you were used to doing a lot of talk therapy in addition to prescribing drugs, and you'd see personalities change very slowly over the course of long-term therapy. And now with some patients for whom you describe Prozac, you see remarkably quick personality changes. So what has this done to your sense of your job and your sense of when talk therapy is appropriate and when a drug is appropriate?
I think there's been a profound change within my sense of self. I think there's something humanly pleasing about the notion that the truth sets people free, and that the truth, especially discovered in the course of an intimate relationship, is what is able to liberate people of the inhibiting parts of their personality, inhibiting or inhibited. And I think people who go into psychotherapy, especially psychiatrists who come to psychotherapy through medicine, that people who choose to center their careers around psychotherapy are not primarily technicians. They're people who are interested in empathy and intimate human relationships. And I think it is in some ways uncomfortable to discover the power of a technology. And Prozac has a particular feeling to me, not just Prozac, but these new, more potent and specific antidepressants. They're really high-tech design drugs. They come from a level of chemistry with which even most doctors are not familiar. So that here one is using an unknown, high-tech, highly developed substance, putting into someone's body in order to change something that heretofore you thought changed only through an intimate examination of the person's history. So I think there's something disturbing about that, although there's always something wonderful about being able to help. And I think these medicines can be immensely helpful.
You say patients have told you that they've learned a lot about themselves from taking Prozac.
Yeah, you know, I titled the book Listening to Prozac, and I think there's some things, there's a measure of irony embedded in the title. Of course, drugs don't talk to us. But I think patients often act as if the drug were talking. I start the book with a story of a man who was on Prozac ultimately for depression, but who prided himself before medication on his sexually liberated personality. He had fights with his wife because she wouldn't join him in his enjoyment of pornographic videos. And he took the Prozac for depression and also for a degree of compulsiveness. And when he was on the medication, he did very well. He was one of these people who was transformed, was quicker at work, was able to do his job better, felt better than well, like Tess. But in addition, he found he no longer enjoyed pornographic videos. And this was disturbing to him on the basis of thought. That is, he came in and he said, you know, that love of pornography really was a compulsion. It was biological happenstance. And I say in the book that the drug agreed with his wife when she was being critical. And so this was somewhat disconcerting or even humiliating for him.
Because he lost a part of himself that he defined himself by.
Yes. And now we don't have to agree with that. We could say, well, there's another reason why when he felt more secure, he didn't need to fall back on videos. Because I think that these drugs give people, for those who respond to them, give them a sense of security and confidence. And one could say, well, when a person's secure, he doesn't need the sorts of responses to anxiety that he relied on before. But I think the patient experienced this with great immediacy. It felt to him as if a compulsion had been removed. He thought he learned something about himself, and that's part of what I mean by listening to Prozac, that he felt the drug had told him something about the deepest part of himself, about what was really self and what was just happenstance.
Do you think drugs like Prozac are raising new questions about what creates personality? For instance, some drugs have led to theories that depression is caused by a chemical imbalance that can be fixed with medication. Are there similar theories now arising about personality that it has a kind of chemical basis?
Yes, there are these theories go up and down. There's an interesting researcher at the University of Washington, St. Louis, named Bob Cloninger, who initially outlined a theory of personality based on the very same neurotransmitters that we think about in depression and in diseases like schizophrenia. so that he thought that these neurotransmitters, dopamine, norepinephrine, and serotonin, affected axes of personalities like harm avoidance or risk-taking, and that you could really describe a person in terms of his levels of these neurotransmitters. Now, I just was at the annual psychiatric meetings in May in San Francisco, and Dr. Cloninger had dropped parts of this theory and added other elements of personality. So I don't think we're at the stage where we can define personality biologically. Thank goodness, I might add. But I think that more and more different parts of what we consider to be intimate to personality are considered to be biological. For instance, there's this whole body of research on social inhibition or inhibition to novelty in children, children who are afraid either socially or afraid of new situations. And there's some evidence, not very strong evidence, but stronger than evidence we've had in the past, that this trait is fairly constant throughout life. It's not very constant, but more constant than some other traits, and that it may relate to the state of the neurotransmitters. In fact, you can breed monkeys to be inhibited in this way, and you can treat the inhibition with medications very much like Prozac.
Say you've prescribed Prozac for a patient, and they've undergone what they and what you see as very positive personality changes. Mm-hmm. When they stop taking Prozac, do those changes stick, or do they revert back to who they were before? And if they revert back to who they were before, how do they feel about it?
Some people revert immediately. There's some people who suffer a relapse in depression or just a sense of being unassertive and unconfident as soon as they come off medication. The response seems to be on and off like a switch, and I think these people, that response is quite remarkable. Here are people whose personality seems entirely dependent on the state of whatever neurotransmitters these antidepressants affect. Other people do well for a while but find themselves slowly slipping into a state similar to what they felt before the medication, what they experienced before the medication. Other people just go on and continue to do well. I happened to see Tess, the patient whose story we talked about earlier, just a couple of weeks ago. She's been off medication for many months, and she's doing fine. She says she occasionally feels more depressed than at other times. She goes up and down, and she said she thinks about going on medication now and then. It's as if she were living with a medication as part of her mental world, even though she's not on it. But she hasn't felt she's needed it. And when I saw her, I felt she was still buoyant, resilient, and flexible. I felt she was doing very well. And there are a number of explanations for that. It may be that these medications induce a change in the neurotransmitters or the receptors for neurotransmitters, which is stable. It may also be that just feeling secure for a while allows people to grow or to change their social circumstances in a way that results in what appears to be long-term personality change. So these medications may act an awful lot like depression. They may create a holding environment. They may give a person an experience of success. And people are remarkable. They can give them a chance, and they can build on whatever you give them.
Dr. Peter Kramer is the author of the new book, Listening to Prozac. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Dr. Kramer will be back with us in the second part of our show.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. with new high-tech antidepressant drugs? Are we treating mental sickness or medicating the human condition? Coming up, we continue our conversation with psychiatrist Peter Kramer. He wrote his new book, Listening to Prozac, after seeing how the antidepressant drug Prozac altered the personalities of some of his patients. For many, it had a positive effect, but its effectiveness has raised troubling ethical and social questions. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews The Bliss Album, the new recording by the rap group PM Dawn. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Guatemala's vice president has declared himself the new president of the country, denying the military's claim that he had resigned. He replaces Jorge Serrano, who was forced from office yesterday. Serrano has now left the country, but as Tom Gibb reports, he has left behind a government in confusion.
In the plan announced yesterday by the defense minister for transition back to constitutional rule, the vice president, Gustavo Espina, was supposed to be a figurehead until a new civilian president could be chosen by Congress. The defense minister, General Jose Garcia Samayoa, said Espina had already resigned, and it was just a question of Congress accepting the resignation. Today, Espina denied that he'd ever resigned and declared himself the new president. He defended former President Serrano, who was removed from power yesterday, and he warned congressmen that he'd start to expose corrupt deputies in public. His declaration has thrown the transition back to democratic rule into confusion. For National Public Radio, this is Tom Gibb in Guatemala City.
Secretary of Defense Les Aspin said today that warning signs must be heeded in order to ensure the quality of U.S. troops. Speaking to the graduating class of the Air Force Academy in Colorado, the secretary said that cutbacks in the defense budget, downsizing, and social changes that face the military could mean some turbulent times ahead. NPR's Martha Raddatz reports.
Secretary Aspin cited recent Defense Department figures that show a decline in the quality of military recruits after years of steady increases. While the decline is only slight, Aspin is concerned about the causes.
Our forces are shrinking big time, and that could cause big time turbulence.
Aspin believes that because of downsizing, people may worry about job security and whether the military is still looking for talented recruits. Changes regarding gays in the military and women in combat could also cause problems, he said. To help maintain current military standards, Aspin says more money will now be spent to attract recruits, and those qualified individuals already in the military will be offered reenlistment bonuses in hopes that they remain in the service. I'm Martha Raddatz in Washington.
Officials of the United Mine Workers Union have announced plans to expand a coal strike tonight by pulling several thousand more miners off the job. At midnight, the strike will extend to Ohio, where some 400 miners will be off the job. There's strikes now at targeted mines in western Virginia, Pennsylvania, Illinois, and Indiana. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 1 point to close at 3,553.45 on volume of more than 287 million shares. Trading was heavy. This is NPR News. Five leaders of the European community have agreed to try and get a special summit later this year, as soon as a treaty for EC unity has been ratified. German Chancellor Kohl says that he agrees with France that a special meeting is needed this fall. The treaty calling for common foreign and security policy in a single currency was defeated by voters in Denmark last year. And Britain also had problems in ratifying the agreement, which goes into effect when all 12 EC nations approve it. A Texas appeals court has granted a stay of execution for a convicted murderer. Deborah Frazier of member station KUHF in Houston reports.
The appeals court granted Texas death row inmate Gary Graham a 30-day reprieve. He had been scheduled to be put to death by lethal injection after midnight tonight, which would have been the sixth execution in Texas this year. 29-year-old Graham was convicted of killing a man during a robbery outside a Houston supermarket in 1981. Graham says he's innocent and it was a case of mistaken identity. His attorneys now say they have a witness that will testify to that. Today's day of execution follows several weeks of a high-profile campaign by Graham supporters and movie star Danny Glover to get the case reconsidered. This is Graham's second stay. 30 days ago, Texas Governor Ann Richards gave him his first reprieve just hours before Graham was scheduled to be executed. For National Public Radio, I'm Deborah Frazier in Houston.
The government says that new home sales climbed in April, hitting their highest point in more than 6 years. Officials say that sales more than doubled in the Northeast after dropping in the month of March because of bad weather. The government says that new home sales increased nearly 23% in April, as many analysts predicted no more than a 2% increase. In trading today in Europe, the dollar moved down against other major foreign currencies. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Dr. Peter Kramer, author of the new book Listening to Prozac. It's an exploration of antidepressant drugs and how they're being used to reshape personality. Dr. Kramer is an associate clinical professor of psychiatry at Brown University. He has a private practice in Providence and writes a column for Psychiatric Times. He wrote his book after watching the quick and dramatic personality changes some of his patients underwent while taking Prozac. His book raises many questions about the effect of mood-altering drugs on the modern sense of self. If we can remake personality to some extent through drugs,
yes,
that doctors prescribe, what's the difference between the drugs you would describe in the remaking of the self through, say, marijuana or LSD or cocaine or heroin? Now, granted that some of those drugs that I just mentioned are addicting and, have side effects, but who knows, I mean, what side effects we're going to find out about from Prozac.
Yeah.
Does that raise new questions about those other drugs?
Yes. I think that these new antidepressants are disturbing in just the way that you ask about. After all, a patient like Tess, who came from a very rough background, might under other circumstances be taking street drugs. And there is a theory of street drug taking, which has it that people select drugs on the basis of their neurochemical needs. That is, really, people who are taking cocaine may be people who really would do well on antidepressants. People who are taking opium or heroin may be people who have a neurological problem with violence. I don't think anyone believes that's strictly true, but there's some sense that street drugs are really a form of self-medication, and maybe what's going on with prescribed drugs is something very similar in a controlled setting with fewer side effects and so on. I think that, it will be even more disturbing if we find a short and immediately acting medication that affects personality and doesn't have a lot of side effects. What if there were a form of amphetamine that didn't make people paranoid? So that I think that once you start going down this road of thinking about potent, specific drugs without a lot of side effects that can affect aspects of personality, taking people from one normal state to another normal state, when you start thinking about that, you open a host of questions, and surely one of those questions is, what's the difference between drug taking on the basis of prescriptions and a relationship with a doctor and drug taking, on the basis of buying drugs on the street?
Mm-hmm. How much do we know now about the side effects of Prozac and other antidepressants?
Well, we know a fair amount about the early antidepressants. They were developed in the late 1950s, and people have been on them for a long time, even though they were initially only tested for short-term use. Certainly people have been on them for the long term, and this is very important because newer research seems to indicate that for certain patients, it makes sense to keep them on antidepressants for a very long time. Obviously, we know less about the newer drugs. These drugs are tested in patients who are kept on them for a few months. And in reality, in clinical practice, people are sometimes kept on drugs like Prozac for years. And no one knows what that means. Also, no one knows what the downstream effects are. The drugs that are used to treat schizophrenia, the antipsychotics, turned out very early, it was realized, to have late-appearing or what are called tardive effects. That is, someone would take the medication, might be off the medication for a number of years, and then might get a quite awful neurological syndrome on the basis of having taken the medicine. Of course, we don't know that about Prozac. We don't know what someone who takes Prozac now is going to discover in 20 years. Let me say on the other side, though, that we don't fully know what the bad effects of depression are. It certainly doesn't seem good to be depressed. depression seems to affect the immune system, but more particularly, being depressed seems to predispose people to further depression. The more frequently you're depressed, the more deeply you're depressed, the longer depression lasts, the greater your odds of being depressed in the future. So it's not just that the drugs have unknown side effects down the road. There's some risk in depression and probably even in minor depression.
How often do patients who take Prozac end up with worse depression or feeling even suicidal?
Nobody knows the answer to that. It's probably a small percentage of the time. All antidepressants seem occasionally to cause worsening of depression, and there's been a lot of publicity about Prozac and suicide or violence. On a theoretical basis, Prozac ought to decrease violence. If you give medicines like this to aggressive animals, you decrease their depression. In fact, there's a new word in psychopharmacology, serenic. Certain medications are said to be serenics because they seem to be able to treat impulsive aggressiveness. And these medicines like Prozac that raise serotonin transmission levels seem to be good at decreasing aggression. However, it may well be on the basis of side effects, and no one knows very well why this ought to be, that occasionally people become more depressed and even violent and suicidal on these medicines. It can't be a very frequent side effect, though. This is a drug that's been given to 4.5 million or more Americans, probably 8 million people or more worldwide. And it doesn't seem to be a side effect that occurs very often, if in fact it occurs at all.
Aren't there a lot of just really common, more minor side effects? Nausea, headaches?
Yes. Yes.
I just want to make it clear about these side effects because we're talking about all these like remarkable personality changes. And I don't want to mislead anybody that it's a wonder drug without side effects.
I think that's a danger. This book has raised for me the question of what the writer's responsibility is. I think someone who reads the book will understand that this is not a drug without side effects. And the book, in fact, isn't a book that says Prozac is wonderful. It's a book that says Prozac is interesting.
Right.
It's remarkable. It's not a panacea. It's not harmless. But I think there's a question about whether I'm just responsible for what I say or whether writers are also responsible for how books are misinterpreted, hyped, and so on. And I really hope that the result of this book is to make people understand better or re-examine how it is they're put together, not to make them run out and take medication inappropriately.
My guest is psychiatrist Peter Kramer. We'll be back after this break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Peter Kramer. He's the author of the new book, Listening to Prozac, A Psychiatrist Explores Antidepressant Drugs and the Remaking of the Self. I'm wondering if you've ever tried Prozac, either for depression or just as an experiment to see what impact it would have on you since you're so interested in the meaning of Prozac now.
I haven't. You know, occasionally a group of friends will get together and say, let's all take this and write a book about it. I feel that I have some kinship to my, I feel I have great kinship to my patients, but in particular, you know, I think we all do have a sense of losing confidence, having our mood drift, thinking less well. I think those states of being a little less sharp are very common, and I suspect that I have a fair sense of what it's like to be up and down in the way my patients are, although maybe not in terms of going down, certainly not to the extent that certainly these patients have. In terms of their experiencing depression. But anyway, I haven't taken the medicine, and I write in the book about what I call psychopharmacological Calvinism, the sense that there's inevitably some bad payback for taking a medication. And perhaps I subscribe to some of that superstition myself.
Do you worry that at some point what we're doing is medicating the human condition, that a certain amount of depression is not only normal, but you'd be crazy if you didn't feel it considering the world we live in? And do you want to medicate that or not, you know?
Yeah, I think it's worse than that. I think we're not only medicating the human condition, we're redefining the human condition. When I say that in rural Greece, women are expected to mourn for 5 years, and here we're expected to mourn for 6 or 12 months, I think medications like these new antidepressants may underline the sense that mourning for more than 6 or 12 months is pathology. So that, you know, I think it goes beyond medicating the human condition. We may redefine the human condition in a way that downplays the role of suffering or difficult emotion. I was on the radio once before being interviewed. This is only my second radio interview. And out in the, it was on KPFA Pacifica in Berkeley, which is a, take it a somewhat left-wing, liberal, anyway, news station. And on the wall outside was a painting which talked about someone feeling pain, going down into the pain, and going down into El Salvador. There was a sense that somebody had transformed her pain into political action. Well, I think that these new antidepressants aren't about transforming your pain into political action. They're about removing pain. However, that being said, I think that people who are marginalized because they're unable to act politically, in fact, unable to act at all socially, are given power by these new antidepressants. So that I think there's something to be said for them on that score, that there, it really is different to take a medication and have it make you passive and medicated, quotes around medicated, and taking a medication and having it make you active and assertive.
Well, I think it's fair to say you're raising a lot of interesting questions, but you don't want to give us any simple answers for them.
Thank you. I hope that's right.
How much does Prozac cost, and how much do you think that the cost of the psychiatrist and the cost of the drug will determine who gets to have the kind of personality changes that will help them and who doesn't?
Right. Well, you know, this is an old question with psychotherapy. Is psychotherapy or psychoanalysis just for the rich? And I think under any health insurance scheme, medication is going to be less expensive than psychotherapy. So Prozac costs about $2 a pill, but that is still less expensive than good psychotherapy by a well-trained therapist. And I think there's the danger under managed care or managed competition that organizations will offer medication and very little psychotherapy by very poorly trained therapists, and that will not serve people well. I do want to say that not everyone responds to the drugs in the way these very good responders do. Some people respond well, some people have an intermediate response, some don't respond at all, and some just experience side effects without any main effect.
Do you feel that other doctors in your field are dealing with the ethical questions that you're raising about when it's appropriate or inappropriate to prescribe antidepressants?
You know, I think that there are doctors who would deny what I'm saying and say that medications only treat illness and that if it responds to medication, it was an illness. I would say that that mischaracterizes most drugs, that most of the drugs we use can affect healthy people as well as ill people, and also that it will serve to expand the definition of illness to a degree that is in itself a form of social change. There's a group of young doctors I mentioned in the book, Bob Aronow and Richard Schwartz at Harvard, Mark Sullivan at University of Washington, Seattle, and Ron Winchell at Columbia, who are very involved in writing and thinking about ethical dilemmas related to these medications. I think it's the younger doctors who just assume that the role of the psychiatrist is going to be to combine psychotherapy and pharmacotherapy, and that this really is the cutting edge. This is the goal of psychiatry in the 1990s and on into the next century, is precisely to wrestle with the practical and the ethical questions involved in using these two very powerful and wonderful tools.
Do you find that you're relying less on talk therapy than you used to?
You know, I tend to use talk therapy with patients as my primary means of treatment and only to give medication secondarily. And there may be good reason for that. The patients I write about in this book very largely have been in psychotherapy either with me or somebody else. And perhaps they just need some small extra thing in order to change. And what appears to be rapid transformation may be rapid transformation after 2 years of psychotherapy. You know, it may be some kind of releasing of a person into some other state for which he or she had the latent potential. However, I think there are people who just do well on these medications without talk, and I think all psychiatrists' sense of what to do first may be changing. I don't think we will ever not need psychotherapy. I really think that there's nothing like self-understanding, experiencing a constant relationship with someone who tolerates and appreciates the other. It would be very disturbing to me if we found medications that could entirely replace psychotherapy.
Dr. Peter Kramer's new book is called Listening to Prozac. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
We'll have an update on the nomination of Lani Guinier, the University of Pennsylvania law professor, who's been nominated to be Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights. Nina Totenberg reports on the politics of that nomination right now. There's a lot of opposition to her on Capitol Hill. Some statements out of the administration today that they're going to stand by her, despite a New York Times news story to the contrary. It's probably one of the subjects we'll be hearing from David Gergen about. He's the new counselor to the president. He'll be on the program today answering some of our questions. Also, we'll be hearing from Frederick Wiseman, the documentary filmmaker, about his latest film for public television, Zoo, about the Miami Zoo.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Over the past few years, hip-hop music has developed a softer bohemian side with the music of groups like De La Soul, Arrested Development, Basshead, and PM Dawn. PM Dawn's 1990 debut was called Of the Heart, of the Soul, and of the Cross, The Utopian Experience. Their new release is called The Bliss Album, Vibrations of Love and Anger and the Ponderance of Life and Existence. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
Whatever it is I do, I try to think about you.
For you, but nothing hides me.
Oh, whatever it is, I'm always thinking of you.
I hope you look at me with patient eyes.
In the 1920s, the surrealists in France used to have a slogan: parents, tell your children your dreams. PM Dawn, a surrealist hip-hop act if there's ever been one, certainly seems to understand this exhortation and to have taken it to heart. Their two albums amount to dream diaries, full of languid music that glows with images of the unconscious.
I wore a ring that was taken so hastily, thinking naively that it guaranteed my safety. I'm looking at eyes that have stumbled across a shooting star, saying it's alright, know the kind of man you are.
Holding on.
Horse,
but I can practice rides on you. Another world, another space.
PM Dawn consists of exactly two musicians, the brothers Attrell and Jarrett Cordes. Their surface spaciness frequently disguises a charming caginess and wit. Attrell, who calls himself Prince B, espouses a romantic, anti-materialistic philosophy. There's even a song here called Filthy Rich, I Don't Wanna Be. Many hardcore rappers have dismissed PM Dawn as hopeless retro hippies, but that doesn't give credit to the elastic, up-to-the-minute rhythms that the duo creates, or to Prince B's creamy crooning, a hypnotizing voice that falls somewhere between Prince and Marvin Gaye. When PM Dawn is most urgently romantic, as on a song called I'd Die Without You, these psychedelic siblings achieve a striking intensity.
Amazing how some things completely turn around.
It would be really unfortunate if PM Dawn got caught up with trying to justify itself to other rap acts. They waste one cut on this collection doing just that, protesting that they shouldn't be, quote, a scapegoat for faking the funk. That's silly. The Bliss album isn't just charmingly laid back, and it certainly isn't fake. It's blissfully passionate, the sound of 90s rhythm and blues waking up from a dream.
Ken Tucker writes about pop culture for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein, research assistance from Penny Nelson. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, our postponed interview with self-described bad girl, singer-songwriter Jo Carol Pierce. You've probably never heard her music. That's why her famous and lesser-known musician friends have recorded a new tribute album of her songs. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.